sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
GDP contracts 2.8%. Big report coming out this week at the end. We're talking employment. Fed whispers about maybe a rate hike. And our guest, Morgan Housel, going to be talking to us about 140 things in the financial universe, behavioral finance, and all sorts of things. All this and much more on episode number 370 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hello, how are you? Andrew Horowitz here. It is the last week of June, going into July this week, actually, 2014. Thanks for joining me here. I got to tell you something, it's been a rough week. I don't know, I had some kind of a cold or something, and all of a sudden, a couple days ago, my right ear has just been just ringing, can't hear out of it, echoing. And finally, a couple nights ago, it got kind of painful, so I figured, better do something about this. But I got to tell you something, talking to people and hearing things was quite unbelievable. I haven't had that happen before. I don't know if you have, but I guess it was a cold in my ear. Sounds like the Israeli prime minister, gold in my ear. Anyway, I wanted to let you know that there is a lot going to be occurring over the next week. We saw that there was a very significant disappointment with GDP in the report this week. And you just got to wonder for a second, wow, we saw a negative 2.8% print or so in revisions to the most recent, and we are seeing a market that won't stop going up. And a lot of you have written up into me and said, hey, what's going on? Why is it that we're seeing that with a print like that, economics, no real earnings to speak of otherwise, and nothing to the contrary, we're seeing that, hey, markets are going up. Well, there's a few reasons. First being, well, you got the Fed. The Fed is just underpinning everything. Janet Yellen is clearly showing that under all circumstances, any circumstances and no circumstances, she's going to continue to press on with her fight to keep interest rates extremely low and to do what you can to support the markets. We'll talk about that a little bit more with our guest today, Morgan Housel, because I have some questions for him on that. The other thing that you notice, though, is then why did the markets go down after that? Well, you had some commentary from Bullard, who is a Fed chief, who said, you know what, the probability is that the economy is strong enough right now to withstand a rate hike. And in fact, that maybe it's time for the Fed to actually go about thinking about increasing rates or at least doing something that will pull back some of the stimulus at a faster clip than had been thought at first. Now, this is one of those trial balloons that we have seen so many times where you just see the Fed talking about things. How do the markets react? And if it doesn't act well, they'll come back and they'll reverse it. Somebody else will come out and talk about it. They'll have another part of the parade come out and say, hey, you know what? Interest rates are going to stay down for a long period. We get this conflicting data constantly. And the whole idea, really, seriously, and you really have to believe this, is to not to mess with your mind, but to educate and to properly find a process that can, well, manage the herd when it comes to markets. Because one of the things that the Fed has done is has effectively massaged the markets to a place they want them to be in order to meet some of their goals, which is based on the wealth effect of increasing valuations of houses, of also assets, et cetera, which they've done a good job. The big question is, you know, do we have inflation? There was a few articles written over the weekend about how there is inflation, but it's just not showing up in the traditional measures. You have asset inflation, and you also have inflation when you look at some of the metrics going backward in terms of what people actually pay. The question is, does the Fed care about that? Again, some more things I'm going to talk to Morgan Housel about. The big report coming up Friday, we have unemployment coming up at the end of this week. It's the first week of the month, first Friday of the month, actually. Let me give you a rundown of what we have on economics. which, by the way, between you and me, probably don't mean a darn thing, because if they're bad, that means, well, probably we had some weather and doesn't really matter because it will get better. And if it's not that excuse, well, we have the Fed to support the markets anyway. So really kind of have the perfect storm in a way in terms of having optimism baked into the markets, not to mention the fact that we had in this quarter so far the largest M&A activity that we've seen in 7 years. A lot of it in the tech and biotech area, but it is going on, and that is something to be said about the optimism that people have. Because when you see a stock, let's say that stock A in the technology area is buying stock B, company B, and that company B has some competitors out there. Well, what happens is that company B is now all of a sudden an exciting potential for takeover. And it's also interesting when you see that there are companies that are getting into businesses that are competing with other companies. For example, Amazon's talking about a food delivery service. Clearly, that is going to be competition for Grubhub. Grubhub was down about 6 or 7% on the news, but the following day was only down about 1.5% when Amazon was also down about 1%. So it really wasn't affecting that. We saw that Apple got into the streaming radio, and they bought Beats, and you would think that maybe Pandora would have some problems. It did, but still, they popped up pretty nicely. Remember when AT&T came out, and they talked about how they were getting into the in-flight internet, and we saw that GoGo got just trashed for a couple of days and then came right back. Well, it didn't come all the way up, but it came up. And there's the idea that the competition is good, and that's the environment we're in right now. We see that takeovers are good, and it leads to many of the stocks that are out there being essentially overvalued for what they are because they're being speculated on as takeover candidates. And when you have the competition that is coming in, so Amazon now doing their food delivery and they're competing against Grubhub, well, why does Grubhub not go down? Well, because maybe there's like a Google or somebody else is going to come out and maybe buy Grubhub so they can compete with Amazon instead of creating their own entire business model. Maybe let's go out and purchase a company and easily get involved in this business if, in fact, it is profitable. Anyway, that's some of the backdrop of what's going on and the optimism that's going on, that you have both the idea that economics are going to get better, although I must tell you that if we had, right, I think we're beyond, I think we're really beyond the weather excuse, don't you think? I mean, that's played its course. Okay, and a lot of things are picking up, but some things are not. Consumer spending has been a bit, you know, down in the dumps compared to where you would have thought it would have been. It's back up a bit, but we were supposed to see a big move higher. It didn't. It just kind of just came back to where the norms were, so they got that gap in between. You have also the fact that you have a GDP at a negative 2.8. Now, the idea is, well, hey, wait a second. A negative 2.8% print means that when we look quarter over quarter, it could see a nice move higher next quarter comparatively, and we don't have to worry about a recession. Recession is two quarters in a row of GDP contraction. And the worse you have it in any given month, the more opportunity you have on a quarter over quarter basis, at least, to see the change. Now, year over year is different, but one quarter to the next, it could be better. So the question is going to be, will we have the opportunity to actually see, as crazy as this may sound, in an economy that has been strengthening and the market that is reaching new highs, a recession pull up? We'll take a look at that. Watch for that. Now let's talk about the economics that are coming out in the week ahead. We have a few things in the beginning of the week. The pending home sales are on the 30th on Monday, looking at a negative 9.6% year over year growth in pending home sales. Month over month, only about a 1.2% increase. Last month, we saw a negative 9.4%. ISM manufacturing, a very important number. Last period, it was 55.4. Expectations are for 55.8. Over 50 is expansion. Under 50 is contraction there. Prices paid are looking like they're going to be flat in June of about 60. That's the number you see is 60. We have construction spending coming up month over month, an increase of about 0.5%, which is good. A little bit of increase each and every month helps the housing industry, which has seen a slowdown, by the way. And you can tell by some of the conversation in the earnings reports from some of the builders, even though we did see an amazing, absolutely blowout, I mean a blowout number last week when it came to new home sales. You know, an 18% month over month different in new home sales. Now, that could have been some of the pent-up demand that finally came in after the weather, so I'll give you that. But that's good news for the housing in terms of what has happened. Question is going to be, can that withstand the continual talk of many of these builders about some of the slowdown that's happening in some areas? Clearly, the multifamily housing is doing okay, and we have that, you know, some pockets around the country that are doing well. The cost for rent and the cost for buying a home in New York is just off the charts. All right, so then let's fast forward to what gets into the more important numbers of the week. The ADP employment change on Wednesday, 205,000, which is increased from 179 in the previous month. Factory orders look like they're going to drop, which makes sense because there was an inventory build, which is some of the blame, or an inventory drop and then a build, but some of the blame for the GDP cut that we saw back down to negative 2.8%. And then we had the unemployment rate on Friday and change in manufacturing, payrolls, et cetera, looking at about 210,000 new jobs added in the private payrolls. And manufacturing looking at about 10,000 adds. Overall, change in non-farm payrolls about 215. Is expectations right on with what was last month, a 6.3% unemployment rate. What is interesting to look at here is that when we look at average hourly earnings on a month-over-month, it's about a 0.2% increase. And average hourly earnings on a year-over-year basis is going to be down from what we saw last month. And that's kind of concerning. That's the big issue that's been really perplexing the Fed right now, is the whole idea of wage growth. That's something that they've really been very much concerned of, and something that they've been trying their best to do something about, but they just can't do it. Seems it's just not going to be occurring. And pretty much that's about it. We have the non-manufacturing composite on the 3rd, which is expected to be about the same as last. That's a service index, about 56.3. Now, China came out with some better numbers last week. We saw that. Japan is still struggling after that massive boom they had from retail and spending. And that was due to the idea that, well, there was going to be a new tax that's going to be pretty intense on consumers. So why not start buying things beforehand and really stock up? And that did good for their economy, good for spending, good for GDP, and then just dropped off a cliff. I mean, like 2 or 3 months worth of goods must have been bought. And then we knew this was going to happen. There was a drop off, a major drop off. In fact, spending has continued to contract even 2 months after, when that was not expected. So we'll see how that plays out next month. I would expect that we get back to a normal spending pattern, at least reasonably. But that giant spend that came on because of the taxes really changed the dynamic of what's going on there. Inflation in Japan is about 3.5%. Now, inflation here in the U.S., it's ticking up. No question about that. It's starting to just kind of ever so slowly move higher. The official numbers I'm talking about now. And the question is going to be, we are seeing that a number of companies are increasing their pricing, whether it's for food or additives, or whether it's for chemicals or construction, or whether it's for anything, whether it's for clothing, et cetera, input prices are going up. I think we're going to see the start of a press by many companies, because really after they clean up their balance sheets, after they lay off people, after they really get everything back in order, they get normalized sales, after all the M&A that goes on, what's next? Only thing they can do to start increasing their EPS bottom line is to expand margins. And one of the ways they do that, and the best way to do that, is by increasing prices. So I think that's the next and the most reasonable estimation of what's going to happen. And increasing prices obviously goes to increasing the CPI and the inflation rate. So I think we're going to be watching for that very carefully and see how the Fed maneuvers, wiggles, and who knows, maybe they even change the actual formula to, you know, figure out what CPI is. It's not, I don't think it's out of bounds that they would do such a thing, because they're totally involved in just pumping it in and really not worrying about what happens until, I guess something happens. Anyway, if you want to contact me at all about anything, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Now let's get to our guest. Our guest today is Morgan Housel. He's a columnist at The Motley Fool, and his work is also featured at The HuffPost, Business Insider, and the USA Today. He's a two-time winner of the Best of Business Award from the Society of American Business Editors and Writers. And it sounds like the cops are after you, buddy.
That's right. They're in full force out here today. Sorry about that.
That's all right. Listen, so I have a lot of things I want to talk to you about. You know, Morgan wrote a great, I guess we'll call it a piece, called The 140 Things to Know About Investing. And also, I know that you are an expert in the areas of behavioral finance and economic history. And I thought we'd start today with just a quick conversation on the idea of what is behavioral finance? What does it tell us? What does it teach us? And how do we utilize that? So why don't you fill us in?
Sounds good. Thanks for having me today. I really think it's true, and a lot of investors miss this over time, that successful investing, if you really study the people that have done well at it, successful investing has less to do with the textbook knowledge that you know about finance and economics. And it has almost everything to do with how you behave in the market. That point is missed a lot of times. You know, what's really interesting, there have been studies that show that investors who have their CFA, their Chartered Financial Analyst, or have an MBA, all these great designations that should confer on them that they are financial experts, that they know how to model earnings, and they know their way in and out of balance sheets and whatnot. These experts don't earn any higher returns on average than the people who don't hold those credentials. There are a few other fields that are like that. You know, if someone were to say that in medicine, someone who did not have an MD was just as good a doctor as someone who did have their MD, that would be crazy. But we virtually see that same thing going on in finance. And the reason, like I said, is because it has almost everything to do with how you act and how you behave. So it's keeping control over your emotions that leads to good investing results over time. It's taking control over behavioral biases that people fall for, whether they're anchoring to past numbers or they let their different political beliefs start swaying their investment decisions. You know, it's pretty clear that those are the things that will lead to good investment results over time. And I think that gets lost on a lot of investors.
You know, right now there's obviously we could put the concept of groupthink into behavioral finance, right?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I mean, that's really what the market is. You know, when the Dow is going up and down every day, that's just a behavior. That's just a reflection of groupthink. There's a great quote by the late Bill Seaman. He said, "You never know what Americans are going to do, but you know they're going to do it all at the exact same time." You know, that's really the psychology of bubbles that's going on. It's either greed or fear, which in itself is okay. The problem is it's when everyone stampedes and does it at the same time that you start getting crazy volatility in the market. And it's much more comfortable for people, rather than thinking for themselves. People want to assume they can think for themselves and that they can have their own opinion, but it is so much more comfortable to just follow the herd around you and have confirmation from your friends and your neighbors and your coworkers that this is the right thing to be doing right now. But when you know that bubbles and busts are caused by groupthink, of course, the smart position to be in is the contrarian. That's almost always the smartest position to be in. But by definition, everyone can't be a contrarian. So people start falling for groupthink.
It reminds me of when somebody told me, you know, I was in a, let me explain what, you know, what everybody thinks. And you go into a room full of 50 people and you say to them, you know, who here thinks you're above average driver? And, you know, 3/4 of the people raise their hand. And, you know, by the very nature, that can't be the case.
Right. You know, there have been studies that ask basically that same question for investors. And there's a really neat way that they track this. It took a group of investors and they said, tell me how you do in the market. Tell me the returns that you have earned. What percentage annual returns have you earned over the last, I think it was 10 years? And then the researchers actually went to those subjects' brokerage accounts and saw how they actually did. And there were some interesting results. One, just like you were just referencing, most of the people thought that they were well above average, but of course most of them were not. They dramatically underperformed the market. But really interesting too, the people who estimated that they were the best actually had the lowest actual returns.
Wow!
So it was the exact opposite of what you would hope to see, and that's a good reflection of how powerful some of the biases are in finance that we fall for.
You know, one of the things I find really interesting is that the current state of the market has an entirely clear bias towards groupthink, behavioral bias, and assumptions about, you know, things that are happening today. And one of the things we know is that it is it's very easy for individuals to forget about something from the past as long as it's kind of like, you know, some time ago. It used to be something like, you know, well, you know, you'd have a correction and people would get nervous and they'd fly out of things. And then they'd finally start saying, okay, well, then I'll start getting back in a little bit later. Corrections have compressed down from, I don't know, 6 weeks, 2 months to a month, then to a week. It looks like corrections are almost half a day these days. And one of the things that we have right now going on is a behavioral finance, a study that could be made on the fact that, you know, markets are just going to go higher end of sentence. And I think a lot of that has to be to do with, and we know that, is that the Fed has programmed investors to understand that they are on their side. I mean, how do we get back to, or do we ever get back to an environment that fundamentals matter?
Well, I think we certainly will. You know, markets over time effectively have to crash, because if there was no volatility in stocks and we never had big corrections, what would happen in that situation? If we actually lived in a world where there were no corrections, what would happen is that stocks would become insanely expensive. They would become almost as expensive as bonds, or they would become almost as expensive so that the return was the same as bonds or even FDIC insured savings accounts. That's what you would expect to happen if there was no volatility in markets. And if stocks did get that expensive, and were you know, at valuations that we saw, say, in 2000, what happens then is that the odds of another crash become much greater. So there's this really interesting paradox in markets. It was first noted by a late economist named Ayn Minsky, who said that stability in itself is destabilizing, because the more stable markets are today, the less stable that they eventually have to become tomorrow. So I think when you understand that concept, it really gets down to markets have to be volatile and have to crash over time. And that's why investors who stick it out over the long run will earn higher returns. That's the cost that they're going to pay for it. You know, that's the cost of admission to earning high returns, is dealing with volatility. So yes, I mean, we absolutely will get back to a period of maybe more sanity. You know, maybe not more sanity. I think that's the wrong way to put it, but more volatility. That's certainly the case. I think when people talk about the Fed, it's important to note that, you know, the Fed's going to be in business for the indefinite future. So a lot of people talk about what happens when the Fed stops helping the economy, or the Fed stops helping investors. Well, that's sort of a stretch. You know, that's the Fed's job is to do what it's been doing. So these chickens will eventually come home to roost. But the Fed is a pretty powerful institution, and it's not going away. So I think there are some investors that maybe think that one day in the near future the Fed is just going to completely stop and take its ball and go home and not care about what the economy or the market's doing anymore. And I think that's a faulty position to take. And I think a lot of investors have been burned taking that position over the last 5 years.
Well, I think though the issue is that historically the Fed hadn't been as acutely aware or even involved with markets rather than the economic situation. I don't think we've seen a Fed historically that had such a predisposition to trying to have a wealth effect, which is market-based, you know, be the catalyst for economic growth. And that's the big differential right now. And the question is, how long can that last? While they do have somewhat and maybe even fully unlimited pocketbook in terms of what they can do, it seems to me that the current administration of the Fed, the people involved at this point, are totally okay with, hey, you know what, let's just keep pushing this thing. And by the way, this spread throughout the world, even in places that, you know, were totally against this kind of action, it spread throughout the world. And the thing is that the Fed has morphed into a much different being than it's ever been. And maybe you could say to me, well, that's because we've never had this situation before. Okay, but you know what? 3 years of zero interest rates and coming back to a reasonable level of unemployment, it seems like the Fed doesn't care about that. Even with their last speech, it said, hey, you know what? We're going to do this way beyond, even if we get back to normal levels of inflation and unemployment. So I think the different animal process and the fact that the Fed has always corrected themselves when even they said they were going to pull out and jumped markets a bit, and the fact that they are now owners, they own a piece of this market, by the way. They own all these bonds more so than they ever have, right?
Well, in bonds, this is a slightly different topic than you were talking about. They own a tremendous amount of treasuries and whatnot right now. Interesting though, as a percentage of the overall treasury market. The Fed actually owns fewer treasuries today than it did 10 years ago before all this started. That was mostly because in 2008, when everything started getting really ugly, the Fed dumped a tremendous amount of treasuries to make room on its balance sheet. So as a share of the entire treasury market, it's not as distorted as I think some people think. But your point is absolutely well taken, that I think for a lot of things the Fed is doing right now, we're in uncharted territory. I don't think anyone can argue against that. I think what I might take issue with, that I think history would bear out, is that there's a difference between being in uncharted territory and assuming that you know what is going to happen next.
Yeah.
And I think the past 5 years have really humbled a lot of very smart people who thought it was very clear as day, as clear as the sun rising tomorrow, that the Fed printing all this money today was going to mean hyperinflation tomorrow. And I think they've learned that the connection between those two variables is more complicated than they think. So I'm certainly not arguing with anything that you said. I absolutely agree with that. I get hesitant when people make specific short-term predictions in terms of what that means is going to happen next. That's where I think investors lead themselves astray.
And I think that by the way, just one more point on what you've said is that when I think the fact that people didn't call the inflation situation right, and even the bond pricing, I mean, when the Fed started tapering, I think what's really interesting about this, what this all says, is if you really bring this down to, okay, why? It's because we were in a much deeper hole than anybody thought.
Right.
That's what the whole point is, that, you know, if we weren't in that much of a deep hole, and if there was this much money printing, then there would be inflation. You follow what I'm saying? In other words, they had to fill this hole, and it was much bigger than anybody thought. That's my interpretation, at least.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a lot of it. You know, the Fed was dumping water into a big bucket, and people said, "Well, there's going to be a flood." They didn't realize that there was a 10-inch hole at the bottom of that bucket.
Right. Exactly.
so that flood might not come. But I also think that a lot of people have learned, myself included, that the how monetary policy works is, I think, substantially different than people assume. And that in the economy that we have, the money supply is determined almost entirely by the private banking sector making loans. And the Fed attempts to influence that loan making by increasing bank reserves, which is what it's doing with QE and whatnot. But it's not a direct correlation that when the Fed is doing QE, that means that there's money sloshing around the normal economy. The interpretation that people gave, sort of a fun interpretation was they started calling Ben Bernanke Helicopter Ben.
Right.
The idea that he was flying around the economy, dumping buckets of money all over the economy. But that wasn't how it was working at all. QE, they're increasing bank reserves, but it was really up to the banking system to loan money. That's how money makes its way into the economy. And we had such a deep banking shock in 2008 and 2009 that wasn't the case. And it was because of the shock, and also because of new regulations that the bank started facing in 2009 and 2010, that lending was constrained far below what would have been needed to ignite so much of that printing to push cash into the economy that would have increased the money supply and led to hyperinflation.
Yeah.
So I really think there are two things. One, we were in a much deeper hole than people assumed. But also, I think a lot of these people that were forecasting hyperinflation in say 2009, 2010, I think had a faulty idea of how monetary policy works. And I would hope that a lot of people have been humbled. And again, I'm not making any pronouncements about what might come next. I think all I'm advocating is humility, that a lot of these things that we think are very simple are actually much more complicated in reality.
Do you think that that there is some kind of, we'll call it, I don't know, AI or some other kind of algorithmic type of process that has been figured out and able to be programmed in a way that can detect, humans and investor behavior and act upon that to cause a profitable circumstance for those that have it? In other words, are there machines that are being run by people with all sorts of money, whether you call it, you know, bankers or you call it hedge funds or whatever it is, that can actually understand, like, okay, this is happening with this stock here and we know where the usual levels are and we're going to go in there and try to do a short squeeze and just blow the shorts out, or, you know, or the opposite way, and kind of, because we do see this kind of even though the markets have been an uptrend for a long time, it's kind of like this, you know, up 2 days and then you see the stock come down the next day and then it comes back up after that. And if it's coming down real hard, you see the big turns. If it comes up real hard, it big turns. Kind of a choreographed.
Well, I think at the very extremely short-term level, when you're talking about high-frequency traders, there you can have algorithms and computers that can effectively predict the future, not because they're even predicting the future, but because they know what other people are going to do, what other traders are going to trade before those trades are actually placed. You know, that's sort of the heart of high-frequency trading. So I think there you can have some short-term arbitrage. But I'm very skeptical about any programs that try to predict what the market is going to do in the next day or week or year, because I think what moves markets almost entirely are human behaviors and emotions that are in themselves inherently just inherently unpredictable. There's no way that anyone could say 1 year from now the average market participant will be in a 6.25% better mood.
Right.
It sounds crazy when you put it that way, but that's effectively what people are trying to do when they're making 1 year market calls.
Yeah, and even like a Jeremy Siegel who looks at, you know, a 5 year market call, and whether or not he's right or not right now, that's not the point. It's pretty ridiculous.
Well, I think what's interesting too is that the longer you go out, then I think the more accurate your predictions can be. And most things that you're trying to predict, that's completely not the case. But I think for markets, it is that we can say with a certain level, a reasonable level of confidence, that over the next 30 years, the markets are going to return, you know, let's say 4 to 6% per year in real terms after inflation. And we can just make that observation because that's what they've done in past in history. And you can look at demographics and say, well, you're going to have X percent in earnings growth. Then that's not saying you're going to be 100% accurate, but you can say that with reasonable certainty. But when people say, what's the market going to do in the next year, you are effectively flipping a coin at that
point.
Yeah, I hear you. And that leads a lot of people astray too, because when they start making predictions about what's going to happen in the next 6 months or the next year, it increases their confidence much more quickly than it increases their ability. So it's not even harmless to make these predictions. It's harmful, and it leads people to bad decisions.
Yep, I hear you. Now, you wrote a piece called 140 Things to Know About Investing. Now, we're not going to go through all these, but...
thank you.
you wrote, here are a few things I've picked up along the way. These are some things that are just, you know, kind of like interesting points, things to think about, and things like, for example, number three, when most people say that they want to be a millionaire, what they really mean is I want to spend $1 million, which is literally the opposite of being a millionaire, which I guess is kind of funny there. You said that 90% of Warren Buffett's success can be explained by three factors: patience, compound interest, and time, which basically they're all the same thing. Exactly right. There's really just one thing. Exactly. Studying successful investors, and you'll notice a common denominator. They are masters of psychology, which is back to behavioral finance here. They can't control the market, but they have complete control over the gray matter between their ears. So they are looking at what you're saying there is that they're understanding more about, hey, you know what? Let's just play the game. Right?
Right. You know, yeah, you know, so many of the most successful long-term investors, we're not talking about people that had a good year or a good quarter, but the people that do well over a 20 or 30-year time stretch, these guys are not PhDs from MITs that sit in their trading room with 16 screens and are constantly trading day in and day out. They're just people that have control over their emotions, who can stick it out over the long run, so that when the market does have a bad quarter or the market does fall 20%, they don't freak out like everyone else. I really think it really comes down to just basic level-headedness and calm behavior that sets these people apart. But I think this is true, especially for young people. There's a tendency to think that the best investor is going to be the guy who has three PhDs from MIT and the guy who was working at the high frequency trading hedge fund. And I really just think over long periods of time, it's really not those people. It's the people that look boring and look like they don't really know what they're talking about, but that are just calm and steady all throughout the course. Those are the people that over long periods of times will by and large be the most successful.
I think number 22 is kind of interesting. You talk about when appearing on CNBC or any other financial talk show, most money managers are introduced with a word about how much money they oversee and not how well they've done doing managing it. There's a reason for that. You say, quote, Joe Smith helps oversee $10 billion, which would be possibly what was his introduction. And it sounds better, of course, than Joe Smith, who has underperformed the market his entire career. Now, obviously, that's a broad-based point, and saying he's underperformed the market. And, sure. You know, the funnier thing about this is that somehow along the way, Joe Smith's company and other Joe Smiths out there have made the market the benchmark. I think that's really funny, actually. In other words, you said that people feel good when they, you know, they're doing what their friends do, and, you know, people are kind of in that whole groupthink thing. I think it's really interesting how it's okay to be down as long as everybody else is down, as an example.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, so many mutual funds these days are not even compared to a benchmark like the S&P 500. But, you know, when people are talking about their returns, they talk about returns versus their peers. And I think one of the reasons that they do that is because, you know, we know the statistics about the percentage of mutual funds that will underperform a benchmark over time. Over a 20-year period, it's 75% of surviving hedge funds, according to Vanguard, that will underperform the benchmark. So when that percentage of the industry will underperform their benchmark, it gets kind of silly to compare yourself to the S&P 500 over time. So then they start comparing themselves to the peers. And just like we were talking about earlier, it's much more comfortable to affiliate yourself with everyone around you than it is to really think for yourself in purely objective terms. So we see that not only with individuals, but for large mutual funds and institutional investors as well.
Right. Number 28, every bubble starts with a rational idea that gets pushed to an irrational extreme. That's why so many people fall for them. You know, it is. It's interesting. Again, and I can only use these days as a comparative. Back in the days when in the 2000, we'll call it, I don't know, 5, 6, everybody was talking about real estate. I remember very well back in 1999 that I would go to a party, you know, and at a party I would be surrounded by all these people that, all my friends, they became day traders, right? You're telling me about right. This stock that made $40 today on, this stock that made $30, crazy things, right? And right. Then everybody kind of quieted down a bit, right? Nobody was doing it anymore because obviously we know what happened after that, right? Nobody would talk about what their losses were because everybody kind of held on to it just thinking, yeah, I'll come back. Then you fast forward to, let's call it 2005, everybody was real estate agents. Like, wait a minute, everybody's buying houses. I'm like, well, what's that about? And it was very much, very clear to me at that time that there was something wrong. Now these days...
Yeah.
These days, I don't know, there's not that much talk about anything, but I'm starting to hear some percolations again about, you know, housing a little bit here and there, and stocks again, not at the same levels by any means.
Well, I think what's interesting about bubbles, too, is that I think it's very easy in hindsight to point out 2007 for dot-com stocks, for 1999 for dot-com stocks, or to point out 2006 for real estate, and point to those as saying, you know, these were obvious tops. But I think at the time, it was probably much less obvious to people than they now believe. I think hindsight bias is a very powerful bias that people fall for. And that's why so many people say now, it was so obvious back then, but then when you ask them to point out what is the bubble of today, they say, well, I don't know if I see much. Maybe it's this, maybe it's that. When you know, it's possible that 5 years from now, we'll be looking back and saying, oh, it was so obvious that in 2014, X was a bubble. I knew it back then.
Right.
But I think people are They underestimate their ability to fool themselves of what they knew at the time. And I think that's another reason bubbles are so dangerous, because in hindsight we say it was so easy to spot, and if it was so easy to spot, that means that I'm definitely going to avoid the next one because I know what I'm looking for. I knew it back then. Of course, I'm going to know it in the future. But that's often not the case. So there are a lot of smart people who I think in 2006 looked at real estate and knew there were problems, but maybe their forecast was, yeah, so we're going to have a couple of flat years here. Maybe things are going to cool off. Very few people said real estate's going to fall 40%. You know, that was, but now people look at it and it seems obvious to them that that was the likely outcome. But back during the time, very few people actually predicted that.
You know, it's interesting because back then I did say that I was like a nut about real estate. And one of the things I said to people, my father-in-law said, you know, I want to buy this property. And I said, well, why is that? This is in whatever year it was, 2005, 2006. And he said, well, I'm going to flip it. I said, oh, okay. Well, how long is it going to take to flip it? Well, from what we're being told, it's about a year because by the time the thing's built, I said, do me a favor. Please, don't do that. I said, you know what? Because in that circumstance, you can be caught, right? You follow what I'm saying? As opposed to a real flip, which is, you know, 2 months, you're in and out, you're done with the thing. And that's, you know, even if you get caught in a bad situation, you're probably not going to get that bad where you have to hold on to it. One of the things I think that, you know, happens with bubbles and with extremes is that it lasts a lot longer than people expect it to. And one of the things I got recently was a bunch of emails from a gent, and he says, you know, I looked at this and I bought some options. I bought a put option on it and this and that and blah, blah, blah. And I don't know why, but I seem to be getting nailed on them and lose money on it every time. And it seems like if I just wait a little longer, you know, like the next month or 3 weeks, I would have been in good shape. So I told him, I said, here's what you do with options. A simple little thing. Whatever you do in your calculations, again, I'm not talking about very short term. I'm talking about maybe 3 months or something when you're looking at certain circumstances, whatever it may be. And this is a general conversation here. I said, you know what? Find what you want, then go out a month. And then go out one more month. And then pick up that month. You follow what I'm saying? Because it seems like it will last a lot longer, you know, in terms of what everybody's expectation is. And trying to thread the needle that tightly is very difficult.
You know, I totally agree with that. I think things that are unprecedented can last for years or even decades longer than people think. The one example of that is it was 1996 that Alan Greenspan first started using the words irrational exuberance to describe the stock market. He first said that in 1996. Well, stocks rallied, surged for another 4 years. If you were looking at real estate in 2002 and you said, this is crazy, this is a bubble, in hindsight, we know you were right. The real prices didn't peak for another 4 or 5 years. So there's a very big difference between people looking at something and saying, this is unsustainable, this is not going to end well, versus saying, this is unsustainable, and therefore I'm going to bet against it that it's going to fall in the next 6 months. Those are very different things for people to understand. And I think that's why even a lot of smart, very smart people who could foresee what was going to happen with real estate or dot-com stocks may have ended up getting burned. There's a really good book called Bull, written by Maggie Mahar, who talks a lot about this, about traders in the 1990s. A lot of people who were prescient in looking at what was going on in dot-com stocks, knowing that was going to end well, a lot of them were virtually traded out of business because they started shorting these stocks in 1996 or 1997. And 2 or 3 years later, by 1999, they're virtually bankrupt. So there's a difference between seeing something and timing something. And that confuses and leads a lot of people astray as well.
Let me ask you what this means here. It says, you say in number 32, Wall Street consistently expects earnings to beat expectations with no sense of irony or appreciation for the word oxymoron. Tell me about
that. Right. So I think something you hear a lot when people are watching CNBC is, you know, you'll have a company that announces earnings and they'll say, well, look, this company beat expectations, but Wall Street was looking for a bigger beat. Well, if the average analyst is expecting earnings to beat expectations, I mean, then I don't think they really understand what the word expectations means. If you're expecting a surprise, then it's not necessarily a surprise anymore, right? And I think that just goes to show that there's a difference between actual numbers and expectations, I guess. And just because a company is expected to earn a dollar a share doesn't mean that earning a dollar and 1 cent is actually going to be good news if everyone is expecting a bigger beat than that. So what you know, in the short term, what drives markets are expectations of what's going to happen. That's why you can have good results that lead to big market declines, and you can have bad results like we saw in 2009 that leads to huge rallies after that. So
So here's the thing that's interesting is that when we talk about earnings and we have estimates that are, let's say, a dollar, and the company naturally beats by $1, right? That's the kind of consistent thing that you see. It's really not a big deal because companies are, and the part of the process is to give analysts information so they can model what the earnings are. Companies know what that is. It's no surprise here, folks, okay? Beating by a penny is kind of the game. That's standard.
And this is we saw this especially in the late 1990s and early 2000s, that it really turned into a game with large blue chip companies, GE, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mae were some of the biggest culprits, of really just completely managing their corporate earnings in order to get them right in line with expectations. Freddie Mac was sued, and I think in 2007, because they showed that in 2002 and 2003, they were systematically underreporting their quarterly earnings, just to be able to give investors a perception that their earnings were more stable quarter to quarter. That's what investors were looking for, was stability in earnings. They didn't want a lot of volatility. So Freddie Mac was actually understating its earnings, which just seems crazy for a company to do. You know, they were earning more money than they were telling investors. Why would anyone do that? Well, it's all an expectations game in the short run, and that leads people to some crazy behavior.
You say, number 78, there will be 7 to 10 recessions over the next 50 years. Don't act surprised when they come. It's kind of, I think these days it'll be pretty surprising. Although we did see a print of a negative 2.8 8 or 9%, and the quote-unquote official recession is two quarters in a row of negative GDP, blah, blah, blah. You know, the potential for having another quarter is pretty low right now due to the fact of how GDP is calculated, some of the things that go into it, some of the reasons we saw such a low print here, obviously. But it is possible.
Well, you know, it's interesting when people talk about recessions, and they say, do you think we're going to have another recession? Well, the answer should always be yes, and of course there will be. We don't know when. Is it going to be 6 months from now or 2 years from now? But of course we're going to have more recessions. It's sort of like asking, is California going to have more earthquakes? Or is Florida going to have another hurricane? Well, if you know anything about the history of California earthquakes or Florida hurricanes or recessions, then the answer is always yes. That question should never be answered with a no. I think with recessions, a lot of people don't think that. They really want to believe when the economy is strong. They really want to extrapolate the recent past into the indefinite future. But the long-term history of markets is just a history of waves from booms to bust, really. So it's, you know, if someone's going to be alive for the next 50 years, they should absolutely count on with near certainty that there are going to be 5, 7, 10 recessions. And that doesn't mean we know when they're going to hit or how bad they're going to happen. But that's a natural part of a capitalistic of a normal capitalistic society that we have.
You know, it's interesting because you know, when you look at recessions, my friend John Markman, who's been on the show many times, talk about, well, what happens during a recession? Why do things change? And he says, just by the very nature of a recession, PE multiples get repriced. It just happens. You know, you see them down instead of at the 17s, you see them down at the 14s and 15s. And, right. You know, the outlook changes and all that. It's almost like an automatic thing you need to put in your mind that if we see a recession, you have to reprice your stock, the concept of what your PEs are, and then bring that. That's why stocks, I mean, that's not why stocks come down, but just keep that in the front of your mind, because if there is, that's what's going to happen. That is what happened over history.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's what moves stocks over time. It's a combination of one, earnings growth, two, dividends, and three, valuation multiples. And the huge variable in there, by far the most important variable, are changes in valuation multiples. And they're high when people are excited, and they get lower when people aren't. And it's a wave over time. And you could look at it right now and say, you know, historically, by most measures, we're pretty high in terms of valuation.
Yep. No, we ran some numbers.
Sure, whether you're looking at 10-year PEs or 4 PEs or trailing PEs, almost any way you want to spin it, your price to sales, it's pretty high right now. So I think what that means is that for long-term investors, you know, the returns that you're going to earn going forward using today as a starting point will be significantly lower than they were 3 or 4 years ago. But I think what it doesn't mean, and that I see a lot of, is when you look at valuation multiples and you say they're high, and then people start making short-term pronouncements about where that's going to lead the market next.
Right.
You have investors like John Hussman, who I think is a very smart guy, but I think has taken valuation measures to bet against the market more or less in the short term, and it's had not very pleasurable results for him over the last 10 years. Even since the inception of his fund, he's lagging the market now. So it just comes down to the difference of seeing something that's true in the market, making an observation like stocks are expensive, is very different from saying, here's what stocks are going to do in the next 6 months or 1 year.
Now, Morgan, one of the things, and we'll finish on this, I think it's interesting, if you come back to what you said earlier, that what I've learned is, you said this, what I learned is that, you know, the way monetary policy works and the way that things happen, and that wasn't really the case. A lot of people were burned by the fact they thought there'd be hyperinflation, all this good stuff, and you really learned things are different, right? That's what you said.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, now, you're open to the fact that you could learn that while things are different, we could have hyperinflation, right? That's not out of the realm of possibility for you, is it?
Absolutely. So all I'm advocating really is humility. So we absolutely could have high inflation, because, you know, what we've learned over the past years is that things are much more complicated than we generally make them out to be. We're an economy just in the United States of 315 million people and 20 million businesses and 17,000 lobbyists and a tax code that has, I think, 71,000 pages right now. People try to distill all of that into two or three variables to make it simple and say, here, you know, by these variables, here's what's going to happen next. And it's just a much more complicated machine than we often make it out to be.
Right.
So, yeah, we absolutely could have hyperinflation in the not-so-near future. You have to consider that as a possibility in the future, because it's happened in the past.
Right.
Anything that's happened in the past can and probably will at some point happen again in the future.
Right.
So it would be crazy to write that off. I think the difference I think that I might take issue with are people that attach near 100% certainties to things that I think are probably less likely than they do. So there are a lot of people 2009, 2010 that considered hyperinflation a near certainty. If someone had said there's a 20, 30, 40% chance of inflation, that's a very different call than saying it's absolutely coming, put your entire net worth in gold, which some people did.
Right.
So it's humility, I think, combined with putting things in probabilities rather than certainties,
right,
that I think is the wisest way to look at the economy going forward.
Well, good stuff from you. Morgan Housel, you can check it out. All the information, we'll put his website and some other information on the show notes of this episode. Hey, I appreciate you coming on. Really good information. Really interesting.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, buddy. See you soon. Bye-bye. Now, that's interesting. You know, we talked a lot about the whole idea of, will there be inflation? Well, maybe not. Maybe we all read this wrong. I mentioned the whole idea about gold. I do still think that is something to look at. As a matter of fact, on DH Unplugged about 2 weeks ago, I started talking about the gold miners. I said, you know what? It just looks like gold is ready to move a little bit. It's just an idea that I was working on. And wouldn't you know it, the investment that I picked, which was a triple ETF that looks at gold miners, up about 40%. In about 3 weeks. Now, will gold and silver hold? I don't know, but I will tell you that we're starting to get closer and closer to the idea that there is the potential for inflation. Now, we talked about here just a moment ago how you don't want to predict that there's going to be this because it happened before. On the other hand, we do say, hey, because it happened before, the probabilities for it to happen again is high of a lot of different things. So why shouldn't the idea that we would have inflation, we'd have a recession, we'd have another crash, or we'd have another rally, or whatever it is, why is that out of the question? I don't think it is. And so gold is getting more and more interesting to me. We'll see if it can actually break out a little bit here, or just stay within this channel. We did see that the dollar had dropped dramatically. It was great. I was looking at a Bloomberg news stream, and there was an article that said, hey, the dollar drops the most due to concerns over economic growth. And the next comment of another story about three down was, stocks rally on expectations for growth. Kind of funny how the news media can, even the same institution, same company, can talk about two things in the same world of what we're seeing and see it two different ways. And that's what makes it all go around, I guess. But you would think that some of the things that are going on right now lead to the idea that gold could be a potential opportunity. Now, for those of you that are gold bugs, you're probably all excited. For those of you that are not, you're probably saying, what is he talking about? Again, I'm not a gold bug here, but it appears that many roads lead to that right now for a lot of different reasons. Look at the potential for inflation, again, closer than further away from it than we are. Look at the safety trade that may occur one day. And where do you go? Do you go to bonds? Stocks? Well, no. What's left? Commodities? Hard assets? Other countries? Maybe, maybe not. Anyway, thanks for joining me. We're going to end it here and pick it up next week with another great guest. And actually, it's going to be the director of a movie. Yes, a movie that you should definitely see. All about the Fed. We'll talk about that in depth and have a great opportunity to speak with him in depth on next week's show. In the meantime, if you want to contact me, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Also, the Aero Strategy, if you haven't checked it out yet, go over to the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and on the right-hand side, you see Arrow. They're blinking somewhere. Click on that. Get the information. Find out more about it, because it has an incredible track record. We flipped it about three times in the last 2 weeks, and it's interesting. It's pointing to the upside right now, but the next leg, from what I can see, it's been in a it was out for a while, then it got in long, and then it moved out, and 2 days later, it got back in onto the long side, which is doing well, but I will tell you that from the way that it looks and the algorithm plays, it looks like the next one could be a neutral or a short call. So just take a look at that. Anyway, thanks for joining me. We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.